student athletes of Dominican
University. I have an announcement before the announcement. Since this is a hall we aren't always in, I wanted to make sure that everyone knew that in case of an emergency, that we will go through the back door where we can go in a orderly line, because you're all very orderly, or out this emergency exit. Hopefully that will never happen, but the best way to guarantee that there won't be any problems is to be prepared. So thank you. Are we ready to roll, Denise? Okay, great. Well, now I'll tell you who I am. I'm Elaine Petrocelli. I have the privilege of being the president of Book Passage. And the first very important thing I have to tell you is to please turn off your cell phones. And I'd also like to remind you that Dominican's Penguin Radio is recording tonight, so you can get it on the radio, on the web. Jody and Ellen have graciously agreed to sign the books afterwards and to personalize. That will be signing tonight's book, Sing You Home, and if you have one other book, they'll sign that one too, and that way everybody will get a chance to meet Jody and Ellen and get a book signed, so I thank you. This is very exciting because it is the beginning of the ILS Spring Lecture Series, and we have a very busy March. Next week, Ted Danson and Pete will be here in conversation with Peter Coyote to talk about Oceana on the 21st of March. Susie Orman will be telling us how to get rich with the money class on the 24th of March. Caroline Kennedy will be here April 13th to present her book of She Walks in Beauty. And Dr. Abraham Verghese will be in conversation with Michael Krasny on April 27th for the final event for the One Book, One Marin of Cutting for Stone. So I hope you've all read your assigned book and you're ready for that. It's really exciting for me to work with Dr. Denise Lucy, who is, as you know, the founder and the head of the Institute for Leadership Studies, as well as an esteemed professor here at Dominican, where she is one of the leaders on the campus and in the community. In recognition of her over 30 years of leadership as an educator, on Saturday night, she will be honored as one of the new inductees to the Marin Women's Hall of Fame. And it is... It's very exciting for me because she's my friend, and I have seen how she works. Our partnership together is because of Denise. She is a yes, we can do it kind of person, and whatever comes up, she always finds a solution, even how to get us in here tonight. So thank you, Denise, for bringing excellence to Marin County and to students who have studied at Dominican from all over the world because of you. So thank you. And would you like to come up for a moment? So we can congratulate you.
Thank you, Elaine. Thank you, Elaine. Thank you for writing 10 letters for me for that Hall of Fame nomination, I'm sure. No, really. Actually, Elaine Petrocelli is also an honoree of the Marin Women's Hall of Fame, and she's just, to be in her, on that list with her, wouldn't you all want to be there with her? So thank you, Elaine, for that graciousness and kind comment. Well, do we have a show for you tonight? And we are sorry that we did have to move the venue. This is the first time in 8 years. We've had an 8-year partnership doing this. And I'm so sorry that it's been we've had to move. But we're going to have a great night, and I know that you'll enjoy every moment. The Institute for Leadership Studies, for those of you who have heard these programs before, is the house at Dominican University of California where we seek to develop leaders, and to do that in many different ways, not just in our educational programs and our training programs for professionals, but in forums like these, so that we can talk about important ideas. Leadership starts from individuals to change the world. And today, do we have the amazing book that's going to change, hopefully change some minds for all of us. And so we're so thrilled, Jody, that you wrote this book. So thank you so much. Let's thank Jody for doing that. So Elaine has spoken a bit about our program. We have remarkable speakers here. And again, without her support, it would never happen. And I also want to thank Simon and Schuster for their support tonight, for also making sure that that Jody could be here tonight. I would like to introduce to you a great person, a great friend, and an amazing leader in our community. Her name is Paula Pilecki. Come on up, Paula. Paula is going to introduce Jody and Ellen Wilbur, who you will meet in a moment. Paula is the executive director of Spectrum, which is a lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender center in San Rafael. Founded in 1982, Spectrum's mission is to promote acceptance, understanding, and full inclusion for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people. Spectrum is one of over 130 LGBT community centers in the United States, working toward a society that celebrates diversity, acknowledges the dignity of LGBT people, and embraces full human rights for all citizens. And it is my great pleasure to have Paula here tonight to introduce our guests, because of her leadership and her efforts, our lives are better. Paula.
Thank you, Dr. Lucy, and congratulations on your induction into the Marin Women's Hall of Fame. It's my pleasure tonight to introduce the first guest speaker of the Institute for Leadership Studies series in 2011, Jody Picot, and musician Ellen Wilbur, who will accompany Jody on stage and perform live tonight. Jody is one of the top-selling novelists in the world, with multiple number one bestsellers in the United States, United Kingdom, Ireland, Australia, and South Africa. She has authored 18 best-selling novels. One of them, My Sister's Keeper, was turned into a New Line Cinema movie in 2009 and directed by Nick Cassavetes and starring Cameron Diaz and Abigail Breslin. Jody has earned a reputation as a hot-button issues writer for popular fiction. Her new book, Sing You Home, has struck a chord. Sing You Home this month debuted at number one on the USA Today book list and number one on the New York Times print and ebook list. In fact, her last five novels have debuted at number one on the New York Times bestseller list. In addition, Jody collaborated with Ellen to compose the musical lyrics for the CD that is included in your book. Ellen is a teacher and musician with over 25 years of experience introducing children to music. She is a member of the Cardigan Mountain Tradition, a bluegrass band, and the founder of a long-running kids' summer theater program. Ellen currently is director for the Trumbull Hall Troupe, for which she has composed over 100 songs. In Sing You Home, Jody writes about the relationship between Zoe and Vanessa and describes what happens when two people live their lives authentically, without fear of judgment. Reading the book, I thought about Mary Oliver's poem, Wild Geese, especially these lines. You do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert, repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. Absent the construct that romantic love can occur only between a man and a woman, a whole new world of possibilities opens up to us. Jody's book captures this so beautifully. It pays off to follow our hearts, in spite of the political, legal, and religious barriers in place to block an authentic journey. It is my esteemed honor to introduce the author whose compelling works have motivated us, captivated us, and the musician whose creativity lends songs to sing you home. Please welcome Jody Picot and Ellen Wilbur.
was such a great introduction that I'm never leaving. I'm going to move in here. That was fantastic. It is so great to be here tonight. I'm really excited about doing an event in the San Francisco area. I've been looking forward to this since the beginning of the book tour, and we are going to have so much fun. What I'm going to do tonight is a little different than a traditional book reading, because as you heard, you get to hear a little live concert, too, in the middle of it. But I'm going to begin by telling you about Sing You Home and where this book came from for me. Sing You Home is unabashedly about gay rights. It is my personal opinion that gay rights are human rights. And it really frustrates me that America is so behind the times. Because when you travel as much as I do, even just crossing the border into Canada, no one in other countries thinks that gay rights are a big deal. And they don't understand why it's such a hang-up in the United States. I've had many gay friends, I've had gay relatives, and I really wanted to poke that issue with a stick. So I started doing some research, and I was just getting down to writing the book when something happened in my personal life that really changed this book for me. My son Kyle, who was 17 at the time, came out to my husband and myself. Now, I could have told you Kyle was gay when he was 3 years old. It was not a surprise. But, you know, maybe it was a surprise to him. But it was terrific that he felt comfortable enough to share that with us while still in high school, which is like another circle of hell for most people. And the thing about Kyle is he's a remarkable kid. He's 19 now. He's a sophomore at Yale University. He's a straight-A student. He majors in Egyptology and can read hieroglyphs and about five other languages. He's fluent in American Sign Language. He runs a children's outreach theater group to disadvantaged kids in New Haven, and he competes in ballroom dance. And frankly, the least interesting thing about my son is his sexual orientation. So... he'd be so excited to know you're all clapping for him. But, you know, suddenly, for me, I'm writing this book, and it's about gay rights, and it's not just a philosophical journey anymore. Suddenly, it is a very personal one, and it's a mission for a mom. Because when Kyle's old enough to get married and have kids, I sure don't want him to have to jump through any hoops. So I started to think a little bit more about this book and why I was writing it. It seems to me that the people in this country who lobby the hardest against gay rights are people who say they don't know anyone gay. They've never talked to someone gay. They don't have a gay relative. They don't have a gay butcher. I don't believe it. They probably have, but they don't realize it. If they did speak to someone gay, they would know that what gay people want is exactly what anybody else wants. They want to be happy. They want to be healthy. They want to be loved. They want to get married. They want to have a family. It is not rocket science. So I started to think about a storyline that would really allow me to explore this, and I came up with a story about Max and Zoe Baxter. Max and Zoe have been married for 10 years, and they have fought for 10 years to try to have a child. After many failed in vitro attempts, Zoe finally becomes pregnant, and in her eighth month, she miscarries. The strain of that breaks apart the relationship, and she winds up... they go separate ways, and they deal with their grief in very separate ways. Max becomes an alcoholic and winds up being redeemed by his brother's very right-wing conservative evangelical church. Zoe, in the meantime, throws herself into her work. She's a music therapist, which means that she uses music in a clinical setting to change social or physiological or emotional health in some way. And she is asked by a school counselor to come and work with a girl who's suicidal, a teenage girl. And as she works with this girl, she and the school counselor, whose name is Vanessa, become good friends. And then Zoe realizes she kind of wants to be more than friends, that for the first time in her life, she's fallen in love with another woman. I'm not going to tell you anything else, because I always prefer when my characters do that themselves. So instead, I'm going to do a short reading for you from Zoe's voice. Everyone wants to know what the sex is like. It's different from being with a man for all the obvious reasons and many more that you'd never imagine. It's the freedom to not have to suck in your stomach or think about cellulite. It's being able to say, that feels good, and more important, that doesn't. But the real difference between my marriage to Max and my relationship with Vanessa has nothing to do with sex, actually. It's about balance. We have a household to run. There's no man who's expected to change the light bulbs that burn out or take out the trash. If something heavy has to be moved, we do it together. One of us has to mow the lawn, pay the bills, clean out the gutters. You'd think that by now, a few months into this relationship, some of the blush has worn off, that I might love Vanessa but not be quite as in love with her, but it's not true. She's still the one I can't wait to call after something phenomenal happens at work. She's the one I want to celebrate with when 3 months after my hysterectomy, I'm still cancer-free. She's the one I want to run errands with on the weekend, which is how we find ourselves in the grocery store on a Saturday afternoon in March, bumping into my ex-husband. I hug him, a reflexive habit, and try not to look at his black suit and skinny tie. That's the uniform of his newly adopted evangelical church, the one I still can't believe he's joined. I can feel Vanessa burning behind me, waiting for an introduction, but the words get stuck in my throat. Vanessa stares at me, and then her mouth tightens. "I'm going to go grab the produce," she says. But as she moves away, I feel something snap inside my chest, like a string too tightly wound. "We're having a chicken pie supper at the church," Max says. "You two should come." Fat chance, I think. We'd probably be tarred and feathered. I mumble a response and make a beeline for Vanessa. "You're pissed at me," I say. She sets down the fruit. "Look, I am the last person in the world who wants to wave a banner or march in a pride parade, and I get that it's not easy to tell someone you used to love that you love someone else, but when you don't say it out loud, that's when people fill in the silence with their own stupid assumptions. Don't you believe that if Max knew you were in a same-sex relationship, he might think twice before he pickets against gays again? Because all of a sudden, it's not some faceless queer in a crowd, Zoe. It's someone he knows." It's raining by the time I catch up to Max at his truck. "That woman I'm with, Vanessa," I say. "She's my new partner." Max looks at me like I'm crazy. Why would I run out in the rain to tell him this? "That's great," he says. "You always wanted someone to go into business with." I shake my head. "Vanessa is my partner," I repeat. "We're together." Before I know it, I'm headed back to Vanessa, who's waiting with the grocery cart under the dry overhang of the store. I put my hands on either side of her face, and I kiss her. I hope Max is watching. I hope the whole world is. When Vanessa proposed, I never even thought twice about saying yes, but I would have been entirely happy to get married at a courthouse in Massachusetts instead of having a big ceremony and reception. "Come on, Zoe," she said. "There are two times in your life everyone you love comes together, your wedding and your funeral, and I know I won't have nearly as much fun at the second one." Unlike me, she'd never walked down an aisle. She'd never been fed wedding cake or danced until there were blisters on her feet. If that was what she wanted, I wasn't going to deny her the experience. But to get married, we had to cross the Rhode Island border. We had to find a minister who was supportive of gay marriage. We had to visit a lawyer to give each other power of attorney for medical decisions, to become beneficiaries on each other's life insurance policies. I wasn't ashamed of wanting a lifetime with Vanessa. But I was ashamed that the steps I had to take in order to do it made me feel like a second-class citizen. I know it's supposed to be good luck if it rains on your wedding, but I'm not sure what it means when there's a blizzard. The freak April snowstorm the weathermen have predicted has taken a turn for the worse, and now, if a weather disaster isn't enough, there's a plumbing snafu, too. The pipes burst at the restaurant where we were planning to hold our reception, and our wedding planner, Joel, has to frantically find a replacement. Joel sticks his head inside the door. "You ready?" I take a deep breath. "I guess so. You know, I tried to get you a gay magician for the reception, but it didn't work out. He vanished with a poof." I follow Joel out of the women's room and wait while he gets Vanessa. She's wearing her white suit. "Wow," she says, staring at me. Joel leads us through a tangle of gears and pulleys, past stacks of boxes and through a doorway. A string quartet begins to play. Together, Vanessa and I step onto the aisle of the bowling alley we will be walking down. This AMC Lanes and Games, the only spot in town that Joel could rent out completely on short notice, doesn't even look like a bowling alley anymore. There are vines woven with lilies lining the gutters on either side of the aisle. There are fairy lights strung overhead and on the walls. The pinball machines are draped in velvet and covered with heaping bowls of shrimp. The air hockey table sports a champagne fountain. "What a quintessentially lesbian wedding," Vanessa whispers to me. "Who else would tie the knot in a room full of balls?" We are still laughing when we reach the end of the makeshift aisle. The minister is wearing a purple shawl edged with a rainbow of beading. "Vanessa and Zoe," she says, "may you avoid splits and always play a perfect game. And now, I can only say what's been said thousands of times before at thousands of weddings. It took us a long time to figure out how to end our ceremony. You can't very well say, I now pronounce you husband and wife. By the same token, I now pronounce you partners sounds lesser than, not a true marriage. Our minister smiles. Zoe, Vanessa, she says, you may kiss the bride. Just in case you aren't sure that the Highlands Inn is lesbian-friendly after you call its phone number, 877-LESBIN, there is a row of Adirondack chairs in all the colors of the rainbow set on a hilltop. When Vanessa had first given me the brochure for this place, I had balked. Did we have to hide out with fellow lesbians on our honeymoon? Why couldn't we go to the Poconos or Paris like other newlyweds? Well, Vanessa had said, we could, but there we wouldn't be like other newlyweds. Here we are. Here no one bats an eye if we're holding hands or checking into a room with a queen-size bed. Sometimes it's better to sort like with like, Vanessa says at breakfast in the inn's dining room one morning. It's just, you know, you grow up Catholic, and it's kind of nice to talk about the Stations of the Cross and not get a blank stare back in return. Full disclosure, I say, I didn't know the cross had stations. We are interrupted by a shriek of a toddler who's run into the breakfast room, nearly crashing into a waitress. His two mothers are in hot pursuit. Travis! The boy giggles and looks over his shoulder before he ducks under our tablecloth, a human puppy. I'm sorry, one of the women says, scooping him up. We're still looking for his off switch. Maybe, Vanessa says. That'll be us someday. Immediately I feel it, that flush of utter failure. You know I can't have kids. Of course I know that. Vanessa threads her fingers through mine. But Zoe, she says, I can. An embryo is frozen at the blastocyst stage when it is approximately 5 days old. In a sealed straw filled with cryoprotectant fluid, a human antifreeze, it's gradually cooled to minus 196 degrees Celsius. The straw is then attached to an aluminum cane and stored in a canister of liquid nitrogen. It costs $800 a year to keep the embryo frozen. When thawed at room temperature, the cryoprotectant fluid is diluted so the embryo can be restored to its culture medium. It's assessed for damage to see if it's suitable for transfer. If the embryo survives mostly intact, it has a good chance of leading to a successful pregnancy. Cellular damage, if not extensive, is not a deal breaker. Some embryos have been frozen for a decade and have gone on to produce healthy children. According to a 2008 study in the journal Fertility and Sterility, when patients who didn't want more children were asked about their frozen embryos, 53% didn't want to donate them to others because they didn't want their children finding an unknown brother or sister one day, and they didn't want other parents raising their child. 66% said they'd donate the embryos for research, but that option wasn't always available at clinics. 20% said they'd keep the embryos frozen forever. Often, the husband and wife are not in agreement. Max and I have three frozen embryos swimming in liquid nitrogen in a clinic in Wilmington, Rhode Island. And now that Vanessa has mentioned it, I cannot eat or drink or sleep or concentrate. All I can do is think of these babies who are waiting for me. Vanessa and I are standing at the reception window of the fertility clinic. We've got a meeting to discuss a frozen embryo transfer. The nurse finds my name on her computer. There you are. Did you bring your husband today? I feel my face flush. I'm remarried. When I called, you said I needed to come in with my spouse. The nurse looks up at me and then at Vanessa. Just wait here, she says. Zoe? At the sound of my name, I turn to find Dr. Anne Forchette, the clinic director, walking toward me. Why don't you two come into my office? She's a striking woman with a fall of prematurely white hair, a bone-crushing handshake, and a drawl that extends my name by three or four syllables. I'm afraid there was a misunderstanding, she says. Your ex-husband has to sign off on the release of the embryos. Once he does that, we can schedule a transfer. But Max divorced me because he doesn't want to be a father. Well, then it's really all academic, Dr. Forchette replies. That familiar wave of disappointment floods me. Once again, this baby track is full of hurdles. All right, Vanessa says briskly. Is there something Max has to sign? Some form? Dr. Forchette hands her a sheet of paper. You just have him send it back to us, and as soon as we get it, we'll call you. She smiles at us. Congratulations to you both. Vanessa and I don't speak until we are in the elevator. You have to talk to him, she says. And say what? Hey, I'm married to Vanessa, and we want you to be our sperm donor? It's not like that, Vanessa points out. The embryos already exist. What plan does he have for them? The doors slide open on the ground floor. A woman is waiting with a baby in a stroller. The baby is wearing a white hooded sweater with little bear ears sticking up. "I'll try," I say. I find Max at a client's house raking out mulch and twigs from the flower beds in preparation for spring landscaping. "Nice place," I say, looking around the grounds of this McMansion. Max wheels at the sound of my voice. "Zoe, what are you doing here?" "I was wondering if you've got a minute to talk." He wipes the perspiration from his forehead, nods. "Sure, you want to sit down?" He gestures to a stone bench in the middle of a hibernating garden. The granite is cold through the fabric of my jeans. It is so strange to encounter an ex. It's as if you're in a foreign film and what you're saying face to face has nothing to do with the subtitles flowing beneath you. We are so careful not to touch, although once upon a time I slept plastered to him in our bed like lichen on a rock. "I got married," I blurt out. For a second, Max looks completely baffled. Then his eyes widen. "You mean you and Vanessa, yeah." He looks like he's about to be sick. "I'm glad you told me face to face. It would have been really tough to hear that through the grapevine." "There's more," I say, swallowing. "Vanessa and I want to start a family. Vanessa's young and healthy, and there's no reason she can't have a baby." "I can think of a pretty major one," Max says. "Well, actually, that's why I'm here. There are 3 embryos left over from when you and I were trying, and I'd like your permission to use them." With a shaking hand, I pull the form from the clinic out of my purse. "Please, Max, I'm begging you." He takes the piece of paper but doesn't look at it. He doesn't look at me. "Think about it?" I ask. He nods, then folds the paper in half and half again and tucks it into his back pocket. I wonder if he'll even look at it, if he'll tear it up in little pieces and rake it into the dirt, if he'll send it through the wash in his jeans so he can't read the words anymore. I start walking down to the curb where I've left my car, but I'm stopped by Max's voice. "Zoe," he calls out. "I still pray for you, you know." I face him. "I don't need your prayers, Max," I say. "Just your consent." "I like Emma and Hannah." "Does every baby name have to be a palindrome?" Vanessa asks. We sprawl across the living room floor, surrounded by baby name books. I've been pregnant 3 times and have avoided doing just this, hoping. It's a lot easier to not be disappointed when you have no expectations, and yet this time I almost can't help myself. There was something about the way I left things with Max that makes me believe this might actually happen. After all, he didn't say no right away, which is what I expected, and that means he's still thinking, which has to be good, right? The doorbell rings. A man is standing on the porch. He's wearing a baseball cap and a Red Sox sweatshirt, and he doesn't strike me as a serial killer, so I open the door. "Are you Zoe Baxter?" "Yes." He pulls a sheaf of blue papers out of his back pocket. "You've been served." I open the folded document, and words leap off the page at me. 1. The plaintiff is the biological father of these pre-born children, which were conceived during a heterosexual, God-condoned, constitutional marriage for the purposes of being raised in a heterosexual, God-condoned, constitutional marriage. 2. Since these pre-born children were conceived, the parties have divorced. 3. Since the final judgment, the defendant has engaged in a deviant, homosexual lifestyle. Zoe? Vanessa sounds like she's 1,000 miles away. I open my mouth, but nothing comes out. There's no language to describe a betrayal this big. Vanessa starts flipping through the pages so quickly, I expect them to burst into flame. What is this garbage? Equilibrium is nothing more than smoke and mirrors. You can be punched without ever fielding a blow. It's from Max, I say. He's trying to take away our baby. Thank you. So hopefully that tells you a little bit about what the story is. And now I'm going to give you a little treat. Ellen is traveling with me for a very important reason. When you get this book, you'll see that it comes with a CD bound into it. That's because I had this idea when I was writing the book. It seemed to me that the people who, again, oppose gay rights the most are the ones who don't ever talk to someone who's gay. And so I really wanted this lesbian to have her own voice. I didn't just want a narrative voice like the one I just read to you. I wanted a literal voice. Because I think when you have a conversation with someone who is from the LGBT community, it's a lot harder to look at someone face to face and say, no, you don't deserve the things that you want, sorry. So I wanted that voice to slip underneath the skin of people. And I thought, since Zoe was a music therapist, it made perfect sense that she would write her own songs and that she would somehow have songs pouring out her heart to you at different moments in the plot. The problem with this is that I'm not particularly musical. Luckily, I have excellent friends. Ellen is one of my best friends. She is a teacher in the school district, kind of kitty corner to the one that my kids are in. And Ellen and I have worked together for years creating original children's musicals that are performed by a local teen theater troupe to raise money for charity. We've written over 100 songs together. And when I knew I wanted to do this, I said, this is a really different kind of project. Do you think you might want to help me on it? And she said yes, which was great. And then she agreed to be the voice of Zoe on the CD, which is even better because she sings so much better than I do. You should all be really happy about this. And finally, she said that she would take a leave of absence from her teaching position so that she could come out on tour with me and play some of the songs live for all of you, which is really exciting because it makes for a nice little concert in the middle of this book reading. So she's going to play 3 songs for you. She's going to tell me what she's playing. I'm going to tell you where they come in the book so you can kind of reference them, and hopefully you'll enjoy them. Ordinary Life, right? Okay. So we're really excited about this song. This is like our San Francisco song, yeah. So Ordinary Life is what we call the lesbian anthem for this book. That's really what it is. When I was writing the words to this, I would write the lyrics and I would pass them over to Ellen and she would come back with this beautiful melody. The words were so easy for me. I mean, there were almost too many words. In fact, I think we did have to cut some of the stanzas because I had so much to say. And it's probably the angriest song on the CD, but it's not really angry. It's actually just, it's reality, sadly. But we wanted to talk about, you know, how it doesn't really matter who's in a relationship. It doesn't matter if it's a guy and a girl, 2 guys, 2 girls. Love is love, period. And there's nothing strange about that. And that's really, to me, what this song is about. So here's Ordinary Life.
Wake up in the morning, brush my teeth and comb my hair. Look outside the window to see if the paper's there. You make a pot of coffee. About the weather, we talk about the weekend when it's time to be together. I pour a bowl of oatmeal, you say the milk is gone. What part of this ordinary life is wrong? Big brothers in my living room offering critiques. Pastor yells and tells me I should turn the other cheek. Census taker says there is no label for my sin. Doctor's office will not let me be the next of kin. It's a different drummer, but still the same old song. What part of this ordinary poster child, I am not a cause. I won't be a scapegoat while you rewrite the laws. I know what makes a family. I don't need it defined. What's missing in your life that makes you take away from mine? Lie beneath the covers and I reach for the remote. We fight over which idol singer ought to get our vote. The moon waits on the windowsill, effortlessly bright. We turn off the TV, set the alarm, and kiss goodnight. If this is abnormality, then where has normal gone? What part of this ordinary life is wrong? Yes, minds become so narrow that they cannot let in light. I want to focus on my family, but you won't give me the right. Don't mean to push a button, don't mean to strike a nerve. Just want the things the Constitution says that I deserve. How How dare you come inside my home and say I don't belong? What part of this ordinary life is wrong?
So Ellen and I always say that we can totally imagine Melissa Etheridge singing that. So is she by any chance a Dominican University graduate? Because that would be great. If any of you know her, just pass that along. We've got a song for her. So the next song that Ellen is going to be singing for you is called Faith. Faith is paired with a different chapter. And actually, it should be said that there's no right or wrong way to listen to the songs with this book. But the way I envisioned it, each chapter is called a track, and each track corresponds to a song on the CD. And if you listen to it beforehand, it really gives you a very rich understanding of Zoe as she's going through this process and this experience. But you can really do whatever you want to. Faith is actually paired with one of Max's narratives. And I already told you that Max joins this very conservative evangelical church. It should be said flat out that this book is not meant to bash Christianity in any way. Most Christians I know are incredibly accepting people, and they want gay rights, and they're very supportive of it. But there is right now a very vocal minority that unfortunately has the pulpit and has the microphone, and they are the kind of church that Max joins. The reason Zoe is singing this song is because belief means different things to different people. To Max, it almost certainly means belief in a higher power who is dictating what he's supposed to believe about certain social issues. To Zoe, it means believing in yourself for the first time in her life, or maybe even knowing that there's someone who believes in you so strongly that you can get through just about anything. So this is Faith.
So I'd like to tell a little story first. Once upon a time, when I was a younger teacher, I started a program for kids where I live, a theater program for children. And this little boy, this little 10-year-old boy named Ben, came and was a part of my program. And when he was a senior in high school, I actually hired him to be my assistant for this program. And also when he was a senior in high school, he was part of another theater group that I had been a part of for many years called North Country Community Theater. And this was a group of teenagers from about 7 different high schools in our geographic area that came together every winter to put on a musical show. And during that last show that we did when Ben was a senior in high school, Ben came out. And there was what you would expect, the normal kinds of reactions. Some kids thought it was the coolest thing ever. They thought, you know, that was just great. And there were some kids who suddenly didn't know if they wanted to be in the show anymore because they thought that this was so wrong. Now, many years later, I have just finished my 18th year with this theater program. Jody actually has done the makeup the last few years for this program. And I don't know, we probably had a dozen kids in the program this year who were openly gay. And Ben is really the one who opened the door for those kids. And I've never forgotten that. The program has never forgotten that. But the best part of this story is that he is now living here in San Francisco, and he is trying to make it on his own out here as a 25-year-old man, and he's here tonight. So, Ben, this song is for you.
Didn't say there'd be no pain. Instead, you made me strong. You didn't say I'd have a voice, but you gave me a song. You didn't promise safety, but you made sure that I hid. I know there is a reason that I found you.
I cannot spot the air. Take that first step, even though I can't make out the stairs. Faith is being sure of things that others cannot see. I believe in you because you believed in me. I'd rather walk on water than skate upon thin ice. I'm learning what is gained from selfless sacrifice. Stepping off a cliff, beneath my feet is sky. But if you cannot catch me, you'll teach me how to fly. I know the moon will pull the tide behind it every night. I know there's electricity, because I spy the light. Faith is being sure of things that others cannot see. I believe in you because you different from what I used to dream. The castle's not a castle. Love's never what it seems. Don't need a happy ending, just a second start. Won't listen to my mind, 'cause I'm leading with. Sun. Can't predict the future, but tomorrow's gonna come. Faith is being sure of things that others cannot see. I believe in you because you.
So the final song that Ellen is going to play tonight is actually my favorite on the CD, and it is called Sammy's Song. I wanted to write a song about the experience of having a daughter and all the wonderful moments that you get to live along with your daughter in her life. And when I started to write the lyrics, I stole heavily from my own experience with my daughter. If you know me or if you stalk me, you know I have three kids. And my youngest is a little girl who is now 15. She was 13 when we wrote this song. And everything that's in this song is something that Sammy and I have experienced together. And when Ellen came back to me with the melody, I loved it so much that I knew I had to keep it as Sammy's song. It was going to be her song forever. But that meant I had to name a character in the book Sammy. As you can imagine, her brothers are really angry. So they don't have names in the book, they don't have a song, but I love when Ellen plays this because it's a little bit like Sammy's right here with me, and also I get to watch all the moms in the audience tear up a little, so that's kind of fun for me too. So this is Sammy's song.
It's 5 a.m., we're in the kitchen after a nightmare. Making pancakes and there's batter on your face, your hair. The sun comes up and paints the sky and you just stop and stare. Do it again, you say, as if might have hung it there. I don't remember who I was before you came. No, the life I have will never be the same. I think my arms are a fortress. I think I have all the answers. You know it's a fact, I'll love you to the moon and back. And now you're 9 under the covers and your eyes are bright. Dreams of princesses and fairy dust and fearless knights. Just one more page you beg, but I turn out the light. You find me even in the dark and hold me tight. I don't remember who I was before you came. I swear this love's so big, it doesn't have a name. I think my arms are a fortress. I think I have all the answers. You know it's a fact. I love you to the moon and back. I'll be your shoulder to cry on. And I'll teach you all that I know. When it's time to break free, somehow be strong and let go. Now you are 13 and you tell me that you've just been kissed. It's no big deal, you say, but you glow as you reminisce. I always knew that one day it would come to this. Just underestimated the moments I would miss. I don't remember who I was before you came. My heart was yours before you ever staked a claim. I watch you take the wheel now, find your own sense of direction. You're right on track, keep heading to the moon and back.
Thank you, Ellen. You got me all teary tonight. Yeah, I hear this every night, and I got all teary tonight. So that was a really good one. So hopefully you enjoyed that. And now we're going to move back to the traditional stodgy book event. And I'm going to let you guys ask me some questions. They can be about anything at all. I only have one rule when it comes to question and answer sessions, and that is, if you give away the ending of a book, I'm going to kill you. So has anyone got a question for me? Just raise your hand. Yes. Oh, great, we have mics. Excellent.
I'm just interested in your relationship with the legal system. You often bring the court and lawyers into your books. And
my relationship with the legal system. That sounds much dodgier than it really is, doesn't it?
Or, you know, what's your fascination?
Yeah.
What's the background?
Actually, I'll tell you a story first. I remember when my oldest son was 4 years old, he was in nursery school, and I had gone off to Arizona to do research at a prison. And he went into nursery school, and his teacher used to sit, like, you know, at the front of the door and say, "How are you today? How are you today?" As each kid walked in, and he went, "My mommy's in jail today." And she was like, "Oh, isn't that nice?" But, you know, I'm happy to say I don't have a personal relationship with the legal system, but I do like writing about it. I'm not a lawyer. I keep waiting for someone to give me an honorary JD, but it hasn't happened yet. And, you know, for me, if I write about the legal system, it's because I have found something, some weird loophole in the legal system that is so dumb that I feel the need to tell all of you about it, because honestly, most people get their law in America from Law and Order on TV. And so I'll give you an example. When I was writing The Pact, I had learned that I would be called to testify against my child in court, but I would not be called to testify against my husband. And I don't know about you, but I would be far more likely to put my husband away than any of my kids, right? So, you know, so I wanted to create that situation. And if you read the pact, there's a moment where, you know, this mother has to get on the stand and either perjure herself or incriminate her own son. And so, you know, I try to do that. I try to dovetail it somehow into the book. Someone else? Right over here?
I hope you'll be willing to talk a little about your writing process. Like,
sure.
Where do your ideas come from? Mm-hmm. They seem really emotionally powerful. Do you run around in tears half the time? Being strenuously...
Do I look like I run around in tears half the
no,
time?
No, you don't. What do
actually,
you do
I
with...
Actually, I hear that a lot. I hear people say, you're not as depressing as I thought you'd be.
Well, so. No, I don't think... I didn't expect you to be depressing. I expected you to be really smart and kind of researchy. And,
maybe I'm not.
But, yeah. but your characters are so real. Yeah. Where do they come from? Do you dream a lot? Just talk about that some, please.
Well, my ideas come from what-if questions. They come from things that I can't answer, things that upset me. I always describe it like a splinter in your brain. You know how you keep going back and feeling a splinter? Well, that's what it's like, only it's a thought. And if it keeps me up at night, and it keeps me up for several nights in a row, it's probably an excellent idea for a book. Coincidentally, the things that I worry about the most are the same things all of you worry about. That's why I think my topics feel so timely. I get accused of being psychic very often, but I don't think that's true. I think it's just that we all worry about the same things. When I start thinking about a book and I keep coming back to it, eventually characters pop up like little mushrooms. I don't feel as though I create characters, but their voices are very, very clear in my head. I have often said that writing is successful schizophrenia because I get paid to hear voices. And, you know, I hear them. I listen to them, and I feel like I'm writing them down. I'm transcribing them for all of you. After those characters come, they begin to shape out a story for me. And I usually stop at that moment, and I do research. I will research sometimes for months at a time. And what I'm trying to find out is who these characters are, how they live their lives, what their problems are, what their jobs are, whatever I don't know that will give me the authority to write about them sometimes in the first person. That's what I need to know. And it's it all swirls up there. It's like a big tornado, and I can see all the research, and I can see those characters and hear their voices, and it touches down in a first line. And when I hear that first line, it feels like, you know, I can feel it, and I know I've got a first line. That's when I'm allowed to start writing. And that's pretty much how it works. It takes me 9 months to create a book, and that's from the beginning of that idea to the end of the first draft. When I finish, my husband usually ties a congratulations on the new baby balloon onto my office chair. So, somebody else. Yes, over here.
When was the first time you realized you could call yourself a writer?
When was the first time I realized I could call myself a writer? I was probably calling myself a writer when I was 5 years old. You know, the first thing that I apparently wrote, my mom says, was called The Lobster That Was Misunderstood. I was five, and it was illustrated too. And she still has it. But I wrote all the time. I wrote stories. I wrote poetry. I went to college for creative writing. I mean, I wanted to write. But the interesting thing, and I hear this a lot from writers, is you feel like you can't call yourself one until you've been published. That's actually a lie. If you're writing, guess what? You're a writer. And so, like, when I do my research, for example, people say, well, how do you get in touch with all these people? Well, you network, and you say, oh, so-and-so is a fireman. All right, so you write a letter. And you say, hi, my name is so-and-so. I'm a writer, because you're allowed to say that, even if you're not published. I hear that you're an expert on XYZ. I'm writing a book on XYZ. I would love to meet with you. And I'll tell you, in all the years I've been doing this, only once have I not had someone respond to a letter like that. Whether or not I was published, even way at the beginning, people were willing to talk to you. Everyone in America wants to be an expert for a day. So you really are allowed to call yourself a writer. You know, that's the craft. When did I feel like I'd made it? That's a good question. And I would say it wasn't until probably the paperback version of My Sister's Keeper, which was not that long ago. Prior to that, you know, I was thinking, maybe I should get the job application at Home Depot. Things aren't going so well. You know, but it wasn't until the paperback of My Sister's Keeper that stratospherically my sales went up enough that I actually was contributing to our household income. So there's a little life lesson for you. Yeah. Someone else? Yeah.
All right, so my question is, in your earlier books, it doesn't have anything to do with, like, law or the courtroom or anything? You know, like, Songs of the Humpback Whale, they don't go to court. And so just what happened that made you start going that direction with your books?
The first one I wrote that had a legal element to it was Mercy. Mercy was about a euthanasia case. And it was the first time I ever did any exploration into law because it just worked for that book. And I kind of fell in love with it. You know, and so honestly, then I started to think about all these loopholes that I kept finding out. Every time I talked to a lawyer, there was something else they would tell me. And I said, oh my gosh, that's another book. Oh my gosh, that's another book. So I don't always write about the law, but I do like somehow criminally involving, you know, something criminal or something legal. It's a very natural snowballed conclusion because a court case always, you know, sort of funnels down to that one decision too. So it works very well in a storytelling capacity. You guys in the back are not representing. We got to get some questions back there.
Hi. Yeah. Hi. So, trying to figure out how to. You're the writer, so you can restate my okay. question. In looking at sort of public opinion, you write about hot issues. In the course of your studies and research and wandering around in the court of public opinion in America, what is your biggest aha about people and how, and their views or their ability to change their views, or and what are the is there a change, or what would be the biggest change or shift that you've seen in public opinion or the public, or you understand what I'm asking?
Yeah, I know what you're saying. I'm actually going to answer that by telling you about the research for this book because I want to talk about it. You know, I get asked a lot about research and about the reaction to this book. I got to tell you, I have written about religion. I've written about the death penalty. I've written about euthanasia. This is the topic that got America's knickers in a twist. I don't know why. You know, and I find that really sad and really interesting. One of the things that I also found out about this book was that it was the most challenging research I have ever done in my life. I mean, I've done research, you know, by going to a native Eskimo village 100 miles outside of any city in Alaska on the back of a snowmobile and eating dried salmon for a week. You know, that was physically tough, but this was emotionally really difficult for me. And it was because I had a mom hat and I had an author hat. I knew that I couldn't write this book without giving the people whose views are different than mine a fair shake. And to do that, I interviewed people from Focus on the Family. Focus on the Family, if you don't know, is a subset of Exodus International, which is an evangelical organization that on their website says that their mission is to champion freedom from homosexuality through the power of Jesus Christ. They run conferences that are mostly held in the South and the Southwest, where if you are not comfortable being gay or lesbian or anything like that, you can go and they can change you, they say. I will start by telling you what they do not believe, because there are a lot of misconceptions out there. They do not believe that you can cure being gay. They do, however, believe that you can choose not to act on those impulses. So they basically advise celibacy. They do not believe that anyone chooses to be gay, but they also don't believe it's genetic. They think it's a combination of biology and developmental factors, and I'll talk about that in a second. They don't believe that God hates gay people, but they do believe that God exclusively wants heterosexual relationships. So those are some of their basic tenets. Here are the things they also do believe. You are never gay. Gay and lesbian are not nouns to Focus on the Family. You are gay identified or lesbian identified. It's something you can change and take away from who you are. They say in their conferences that a child will be gay if the father is distant and the mother is overbearing. And the language they actually use is, if you don't hug your son, another man will. I spoke for 6 hours to a woman named Melissa Freirier. Melissa was a media representative for Focus on the Family. She has since left the organization. I have no idea where she is. But she used to go around to these conferences and give her testimonial as part of the conferences. Melissa says that she was born gay and then born again. She doesn't like to say that she was ex-gay. She says she was a heterosexual with a homosexual problem. That's the way she phrases it. She told me she has never met anyone gay who was not sexually abused as a child, and she has gone on record saying that. And she says she believes in being for Christ, not anti-gay. We talked a lot about biological studies because that's what they hold up as proof that there isn't a biological connection for being gay. We talked about one that was done by Simon LeVay. He's a scientist who found out that in there's a region of the hypothalamus that in gay men is about 8% smaller than it is in straight men. And Melissa said, you can't count that study because, first of all, the sampling was too small. And second of all, you don't know if it's chicken or egg sort of thing. Did the brain shrink because they were gay, or were they born that way? And before you actually discount that, you should know that if you read Braille and you haven't been blind your whole life, there is a portion of your brain that will expand, which is kind of interesting. Then she talked about something called the Bailey-Pillard twin study, where they've basically said that if one twin is gay, his identical twin brother will be 3 times as likely to be gay as well. And Melissa said, well, come on, if it's biological and they have identical DNA, shouldn't they always be gay? And finally, she talked about Dean Hamer's study, which is commonly referred to as the gay gene. It's actually a piece of the X chromosome that is replicated on gay brothers. And her take on that study is it doesn't count because it's never been replicated. I also brought her other studies that she knew nothing about. Like, for example, in May 2010, scientists were studying rams, Swedish scientists. 8% of rams are exclusively attracted only to other rams, not to ewes. And in those 8% of rams, the hypothalamus is smaller than it is in straight rams. She had never heard of this study. I talked about a study that was done in June in 2010 where Austrian scientists found a switch on the genetic code of the fruit fly. And by literally manipulating that switch, they could determine whether a fruit fly was attracted to male or female fruit flies. She didn't know anything about that research. But for me, the most intriguing research was done by William Reiner, who is a physician in the Midwest, who studied over 100 boys who were born with the birth defect of not having a penis. In every one of those cases, the boy was castrated and raised as a female. And yet in not one out of those 100 plus cases did the child who was raised female grow up to be attracted to men. Instead, all of those kids have transitioned back into male. Of course, when you talk to focus on the family, you cannot get very far without them talking about the Bible. And I could go on for hours about this, because we did, but I'll only focus on one particular passage that she brought up, which, of course, is Leviticus 18:22. You shall not lie with a man as you lie with a woman. It is an abomination. Leviticus is a holiness code that was written 3,000 years ago. A holiness code is not a commandment, and it's not a law. It's a set of behaviors that is offensive to certain people at a certain time and a certain place. Other abominations in the Bible include cutting your hair, touching pig skin, getting a tattoo, eating shellfish, none of which focus on the family has a problem with. And in the New Testament, actually, both Jesus and Paul say that the holiness code in Leviticus doesn't apply to people who consider themselves Christian. So I'm not entirely sure why they use this to their advantage. I mentioned that the Bible does have an awful lot to say, but it makes a pretty lousy sex manual. And that, you know, if you read it carefully, it also says that if a bride gets married, she's not a virgin, she should be stoned to death, that divorce is not allowed, that polygamy is, that you can sell someone into slavery and marry an 11-year-old girl. And when I mentioned all these to Melissa, she said, well, you know, the Bible isn't always God's intent for sexual behavior. So it only is sometimes, I guess, but for me, the hardest moment came when I said to her, do you worry that your message is somehow getting perverted, that people are waving the Bible and using it as an excuse to commit hate crimes against people who are LGBTQ? And she said, she burst into tears, and she said, well, thank God that's never happened. And I went, I was shocked. I couldn't speak. Not very often I am speechless. And I said to her, have you ever heard of Matthew Shepard, Danny Overstreet, Tyler Clementi, any of the 6 kids last year who killed themselves after being bullied for sexual orientation? And she had no response. And taking off my author hat and putting on my mom hat, it is really, really hard to know that there are people out there with that point of view. So, you know, I guess the answer to your question is I have been completely moved by the stories I've heard at every event I've done on this book tour. Kids who have come up to me and said, I came out to my parents and they reacted like Max did. I wish my dad would read this book, knowing that this is still an issue. I have had letters from people who said, I can't read your book because homosexuality is a sin. And when I wrote them back and said, thanks for sharing your point of view, hopefully you can read the book without judging it because your point of view is in there too. I would get a letter back saying, well, the problem is that I was in a same-sex relationship for 20 years, and I'm born again now and married, and I think reading this book would be like being an ex-smoker in a room full of smokers. It would just hit too close to home. And that's not the only letter I've gotten like that. And that kind of thing tells me we have a very long way to go in our society. But, you know, then I'm also getting a lot of mail from people who are saying, thank you, this is my story. And that makes me believe that maybe 20 years from now, the world's going to be a kinder place. Anybody else? Come on, you guys in the back. All right, let's get a mic back there, way in the back.
You talked a lot about your characters like they were their own people, but do you see yourself in them at all?
I don't. I'm really happy to report that, actually, because maybe you've noticed how depressing all my characters are, what awful lives they have. They have horrible things happen to them. I always say that I write about ordinary people with extraordinary situations thrust upon them. Luckily, I am not my characters. I have the best life. I live in a beautiful part of the country. I have this amazing husband who's really cute. I have three happy, healthy kids. You know, I have great friends. I get to wake up every morning and do what I love to do as a job. I mean, you should hate me. I'm that disgusting, you know? And the truth is that it's so easy for me to leave my characters at the end of the day and go downstairs to a world that's completely different because things are much better downstairs than they are up in my office. You know, so I actually can make a very quick break. You know, you always write a little bit of yourself, I think, into every character, and some books have been more personally relevant than others. Obviously, Sing You Home was relevant, as I told you. My Sister's Keeper grew out of experiences I had with my other son, who has had chronic surgeries for a genetic condition of a benign tumor in his ears and has lost hearing because of it. And, you know, so a lot of me was funneled into that experience, too, but I thankfully did not act like Sarah. And, you know, so I think that although pieces of me might wind up in a book, I'm very rarely like any of the characters. I like to say if I had to pick one, I would pick Nina Frost from Perfect Match, which shocks people because she's a little crazy. She's the person who shoots the priest that she thinks is molesting her son, only to find out she shot the wrong guy. And I like to think that I would look before I leap, but I also know that if you cross one of my kids, you're going to have a lot to deal with. So that's why I think I'm like her. Yes. Just yell. Yeah.
You treat men and women protagonists pretty much equally. And yet, based on what we see in this room, there seems to be a larger audience for your books among women rather than men. I don't know if you can answer this question, but do you know why? I mean, this is not...
There isn't. No, it's not chick lit. You know what, you're accused of writing chick lit, frankly, if you have, you know, a vagina. That's pretty much what happens, really. But I don't think I write that. But on the other hand, I was so tired of being called a women's fiction writer because I kept getting these emails from men. I actually did a little study, and I tracked what comes in, because I get about 200 letters a day from fans, and I answer every one. 48% of my email comes from men. So I don't know who thinks I'm a women's fiction writer. What I will tell you is that women come to events, and I think it's frankly because we need the night out. Over there. We got some questions over here.
Can you describe the pact where
the idea of Pen originated from? The pact? Yeah, the question's about the pact and where that originated. Before I was a writer, one of my jobs was as an eighth grade English teacher. And the year that I was teaching eighth grade English, there was a little girl in my class who was suicidal. Everyone knew it. Her parents knew it. Her teachers knew it. Her guidance counselor knew it. And we all were trying really hard to keep her focused and here. And my job, excuse me, as her English teacher, was to get her to write in a journal every day and to talk to her at the end of the day about what she'd written. And I never forgot what it felt like to be a lifeline for someone who is suicidal, and I really wanted to explore that. So when I started to think about the pact, actually, Emily was the character who survived the suicide pact, and Chris was dead. And I went to go start my research, and I went to my local police chief, and he said to me, all right, remind me again, who's alive and who's dead, the boy or the girl, what? And I said, well, you know, the boy's dead and the girl's alive. And he goes, oh, because, you know, if it was the other way around and he was bigger and stronger, we'd book him on charges of murder until we could prove otherwise. And I went, really? And all of a sudden, I didn't just have a character study. I had a murder mystery on my hands. And so just like that, Emily was dead and Chris was alive. Boom. And that was pretty much where the idea for that book came from. I will tell you that that girl wound up connecting with me about 10 years after she'd graduated, and she got 2 PhDs, I think, in neuroscience down in Texas. So she's doing really well right now, which is great. Someone else. Right here. You have to wave big so I can see you. Okay.
The thing I like best about your books is that you always present a story from multiple perspectives, and it makes it so much more real and more compelling to see that. How did you get that idea? It seems like from your first book on, it's always that way.
Because there are so many writers out there that I think preach to you and tell you what to believe. I don't think my opinion is any more valid than your opinion. I don't want to change your mind. I do want you to ask yourself why you believe what you believe. And I think the best way to do that is to look at a controversial situation like a diamond and explore every single facet, lay it out on a table, have the reader read it, and then make a decision, him or herself. You know, it's very interesting in this book because I definitely, and I haven't been shy about my point of view in any way, but the interesting thing about the characters who are cast as my evangelical Christians in this book is it's not that they're two-dimensional. Actually, everything they say and everything they do came from that six-hour interview with Focus on the Family. So for people who read it and say, well, you know, but they're not as rich and developed as the two lesbian women are, that's your opinion. You know, I mean, all I did was present to you exactly what was presented to me. And that's the reader's opinion, which is a pretty important opinion, I think, to realize and think about and stop and reflect on. You know, so it's for me, it's my way of allowing you to make the choice instead of me telling you what to think. All right, there's someone over there who is forcefully waving. Yes, well done.
What's your own personal favorite and why?
My own personal favorite is Second Glance. I always say that, you know, that's my favorite because of many reasons. It had the best research I've ever had to do for a book. I had to go ghost hunting, which was so fun. And it addresses a period of American history when we were in the business of racial hygiene. Very few people know about it. It happened in the 1930s, early 1930s. And it happened not only in Vermont, which I wrote about, but also Virginia and Illinois and California. And Hitler thanked America for doing his homework for him, which very few people realize. So I'm really proud to have illuminated that. But also because it was a very complicated narrative, and I think I nailed it. And as a writer, I'm very proud of it. I always say, though, that you are allowed to have a different favorite as long as I wrote it. So. In the back over there. What am I working on now? I have just finished the rough draft for the 2012 book. It's called Lone Wolf. And it is the story of a wolf researcher who does his research not by observing wolves, but by actually living with a wild pack in Quebec and insinuating himself as a member of the pack. And before you ask, yes, some people do this. And yes, I met with them and they're wolves. And anyway, this guy winds up in a very severe car crash and is in a vegetative state. And his estranged son, who is 23, comes back from overseas because his dad is in such bad condition. And his 17-year-old daughter, who is not of legal majority, is also at his bedside. And the two siblings have very different opinions about what should happen with their father's health care. The son believes that he would want to have life support terminated and organs donated. The daughter believes that he would want to be kept alive no matter what. But unfortunately, she doesn't get a vote because she's only 17. And so when her brother makes steps to begin to terminate life support, she gets him arrested on a charge of attempted murder. So that's coming. Yes. Mm. questions about titles. At what point of the writing process do I come up with the titles? It really depends on the book. Sometimes I know the title before I start writing. Sometimes it comes to me in the act of writing. Sometimes I give it to my publisher and I say, I don't know, take a crack at it. And that's happened to me several times. I did not name The Pact. My publisher at the time named The Pact. Harvesting the Heart was named by my mentor from college because I was stumped. But Sing You Home, I knew was going to be called Sing You Home pretty early on, I think. It seemed to me the right phrase for about bringing a baby into a family that's waiting for it. Yes. How did I do the medical research for Handle With Care? Well, when I do medical research, I treat it like any other research. I go and meet with doctors, I meet with patients, and in Handle With Care, the case of Handle With Care, I met with families that had children who have osteogenesis imperfecta. I knew about it, but I had never really explored it. It grew out of the story of wrongful birth. I really wanted to write about a parent who has a child with a severe disability who gets up on a witness stand, not because she really feels this way, but because she wants to get money to take care of her child. And she says, if I'd known that my child was going to be like this, I would terminate the pregnancy. Because often, juries give you millions of dollars if you say that. But often, parents who do this have a severely compromised child, not just physically, but also mentally. So I thought, well, what if a kid had a really tough time physically, but mentally was 100% there and could understand what you were saying? And osteogenesis imperfecta really qualified for that, which is why I began to explore it. I think we'll take two more questions before we all pass out. Yes? My sister's keeper? Yeah. I don't even need the question. I could just look at you and know it's coming. All right. Okay, so how many people saw My Sister's Keeper, the movie? How many people hated My Sister's Keeper, the movie? Okay, so some of you should hate it more. So here's the story. When you give up the rights for a movie, it's like giving a baby up for adoption. Sometimes you're allowed to believe that she went off to a good home, and sometimes, you know, it doesn't happen that way. But you're not allowed to call every day and say, did you feed her? You just have to hope for the best. When I gave up the rights to My Sister's Keeper at New Line Cinema, I made it very clear that the ending was critical, because most of you read the book because someone threw it at you and said, I can't tell you what happened, just read it. And that's what sold the book. Before Nick Cassavetes was hired as director, they had me call and talk to him. And I explained to him why the ending was so vitally important. And he read the book and he said, you're right, this is the only ending for this story. And I can't promise you nothing's going to change, but if something does, I'm going to tell you why and tell you myself. And I said, that's fair. So I found out that the script had changed and that he had written a different script when a fan who worked at a casting agency called me and said she'd gotten the script and it had a different ending. So I called Nick and I said, what's going on? And he didn't want to talk to me. So I went to the set, and he threw me off the set. And to this day, I don't know why he changed the ending of My Sister's Keeper, because he's never told me. I can tell you that it was not a successful financial movie for New Line Cinema. Big surprise, because the demographic were the readers. And really, the only happy ending that came out of this is that Nick was scheduled to do another movie with New Line Cinema right afterward. He had written a script and was going to direct for the story of a real-life woman who is alive, who does elephant rescue work in Kenya. And apparently, he changed the end of her life even though she's still living it. And he was fired, so that's good. Right. I will tell you, the exciting news about Sing You Home is that Ellen DeGeneres has the rights. So we hope that'll happen. So write to Ellen and tell her to sell it. Last question. What do I read if I ever have time to read? I do read. Everyone says, where do you have time? But I read in the bathtub usually. So my favorite writer is Alice Hoffman. I think she is astounding. And I would read anything she wrote, anything at all, even her grocery list. Even better now, I mean, I used to stalk her because, like, I was her number one fan, but now we're friends, which is the coolest thing in my career, seriously. I'll tell you three books I've read recently that I have found fantastic. One is Room by Emma Donahue. If you haven't read it, you should read it. The second one is The Particular Sadness of Lemon Cake by Amy Bender. Really weird and really cool. And the last book that is great is by Caroline Levitt, and it's called Pictures of You. A lot of people say, well, I've done all your books, so what do I read now? She writes stuff that's very similar to the kind of stuff I write, so you might really like her. So I really want to thank you guys for coming out tonight and being such a great crowd. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to Jodi Picoult on radio.dominican.edu.
Wasn't that fabulous? To get...
Ladies and gentlemen, this is DJ P-Yup from What Are You Talking About? And I'm going to tell you about D...